this legacy still rippling across the globe. Supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker, when children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes. What does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know. You know, and this is just to put people more in poverty. You know, and it's not right. It's not fair. You know, people working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Oh, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
$110,000 relief packages for 110,000 underprivileged families are loaded on trucks and are ready to go to their destinations. The humanitarian gesture was initiated by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. The IRGC says the charity supplies contain staple food, health items and dowries for newlywed couples.
110,000 aid packages are being dispatched to families with low income, with a focus on those who have lost their businesses during the pandemic. The majority of the charitable supplies include the necessary items needed for an average family in a month. We have also provided 313 dowries for 313 newlywed couples.
The humanitarian gesture comes as part of nationwide celebrations marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The IRGC says one of the goals of this move is to share the festive mood with those in need.
We're celebrating the 43rd year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, so we want to spread joy and happiness by helping those who cannot make ends meet. If we the people join hands and help each other, no foreign plot and no sanctions can bring us to our knees.
While the IRGC is known as a military institution, it has a strong presence in social and economic arenas. It says it feels bound to serve the Islamic Republic whenever there's a call to action, be it military or civilian.
Every year during the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, charities in Iran ramp up their activities. The IRGC says the occasion is a chance to put a smile on the faces of the less privileged families, in line with one of the slogans of the Islamic Revolution, and that's the elimination of poverty. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Food and energy prices are soaring across the 19-nation eurozone, placing enormous pressures on cash-strapped consumers. Inflation hit a record high of 5.1% in January. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Wednesday.
I'm highly concerned about the combination of high and increasing levels of inflation and a central bank that refuses to normalize its monetary policy.
The story is not the same everywhere. For example, Belgium has an inflation rate of 8%. In France, it's just 2.5%.
Hence, we will see divergence in international competitiveness of the member states of the euro area. We've seen in the past the misery that comes about when you have that kind of development.
The economic impact of COVID-19 has disproportionately hit young adults in the EU. Homelessness and mental health problems are rife. For example, here in Belgium, PreventSuicide.be published a report on Tuesday showing calls to its helpline have skyrocketed. A record 22,000 were made last year, an increase of 20% on the previous year. The vast majority of those desperately reaching out for support are young people. Due to growing public debt, EU governments have been cutting investment in crucial areas such as education.
That cannot be the right way forward. We are increasingly in a knowledge economy in Europe. We need to invest in our people to really be competitive.
The potential fallout from a conflict between Western-backed Ukraine and Russia is fueling economic uncertainty in the EU.
This is something we have to factor into our economic analysis. And geopolitical tensions and issues, of course, have to be recognised.
Some EU lawmakers say the West should stop provoking Russia and instead put the best interests of citizens first. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to the neo-colonial sphere of influence known as France-Afrique. The reasons included undiplomatic language from Paris towards a new military government in the capital of Bamako, but also sanctions on Mali, which have raised food prices, and especially the failure of almost a decade of French-led war. France first declared war in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali without the United Nations' approval, allegedly to fight religious extremists. 9 years later, with thousands dead and a million refugees, public opinion has turned massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital think that France was only there to defend French interests. It's an opinion which Paris has blamed on Russian disinformation.
Public opinion is also reportedly strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador as well as of the military.
Dans la vision occidentale,
in the Western vision of things, there isn't a desire to respect the majority will of these people, or to help install a minimum of democracy, and thus a government with a minimum of credibility. If you install a government which is pro-Western and which doesn't reflect the popular will, then of course you will create anti-occupation sentiment, because you become a hostile force yourself.
The bold move by Mali comes just days after Burkina Faso's military seized the heads of state, even as French soldiers were on a mission in the country. In the past 18 months, other revolts in Guinea, as well as in Chad and Niger, have many wondering if France is losing its neo-colonial hold on sub-Saharan Africa.
France's interests in the region are threatened by new players such as China, Russia, and even Qatar, which has invested a lot there. We can no longer say this is a region which is under total French domination, because there is now competition. However, as long as the local governments are corrupt, they can be easily influenced by foreign powers.
France's military has stalled for time, saying a total military withdrawal from Mali will be discussed in the coming days. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip staged a rally organized by the Women Framework of the Islamic Jihad movement to voice their support for Palestinians in Negev region in southern parts of the occupied Palestinian territories. The protesters denounced the Israeli regime for violating the rights of locals in Negev and demolishing their homes.
We are here today to support Palestinians in Negev. Israeli regime is trying to demolish our identity by taking over these lands and expelling the Palestinians. Our message is that we will never accept such crimes. All the Palestinians are facing the same struggle and we will remain united.
In recent days, hundreds of Palestinians in Negev have staged protests against their land confiscation by the so-called Jewish National Fund, an organization that collects money from Jews around the world to seize the Palestinian property. The Israeli regime has suppressed the demonstrations, arresting dozens of Palestinians.
Israel has stolen all what is Palestinian for a long time, but our Palestinian resistance keep defending the Palestinian rights by all means, even the armed resistance. Our enemy used every possible chance to press ahead with its apartheid policies of land grabbing, but our national resistance never hesitate to fight in the face of these crimes in all parts of Palestine.
Palestinians are all united in the face of the Israeli occupation and reject as illegal and unacceptable the Israeli land grab policy.
This event is held to voice our support for Palestinians in Negev who are under Israeli illegal land grab policy. This Israeli regime is expelling Palestinians from their lands and replacing them with settlers. We tell them that we maintain our unity and fight back, while we urge the international community to take a serious step to end such crimes.
The number of Palestinians in Negev is estimated at 300,000. Estimates show that they are living on 5% of the land, 95% of which confiscated by Israel. Israel has seized more Palestinian lands in Nakab in the past few years. Protesters here say this is an attempt to expel the Palestinian population from the area, which amounts to crime against humanity. They also stress that Palestinians in Nakab are not alone in their struggle. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iran's biggest cinematic event, the 40th edition of Fajr Film Festival, is underway, playing host to high-profile Iranian filmmakers, critics, and cineasts in Iran's iconic Milad Tower. The annual event rolled down the red carpet for the first time in 2 years, as the festival was held with limited presence last year.
Fajr Film Festival was held without public presence last year due to the pandemic. But this year, we decided to hold it with health protocols in place. Some 61 movie theaters across the country are screening the participating films. That's around 14,000 chairs. But the halls run with 50% of their capacities to comply with the health protocols. Filmgoers are required to show their vaccination card with at least 2 doses. We have also set up vaccination booths for those who have not got their third jabs.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, are competing for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. Among the competing films is Murtaza Ali Abbas Mirzai's Beirut, a sport drama on the life of Iranian goalkeeper Ali Raza Behrahmand, who made a name for himself after catching Cristiano Ronaldo's penalty kick. The Loser Man by Mohammad Hossein Mahdavian and The Situation of Mehdi by Hadi Hejazifar are other highlights of the lineup. After each film is screened, the cast and crew attend a Q&A session with journalists and cineasts.
Fajr Film Festival provides professional and specialized feedbacks on our performance as actors and filmmakers. And it's such criticisms and feedbacks that make us find our deficiencies and try to improve.
Recently, an important and new development has taken place in Fajr Film Festival, and that is the festival is no longer specific for veteran filmmakers, and we see that younger but talented filmmakers also participate and win a prize, so it's changing the film industry for the better.
10 memorable films from renowned Iranian directors will be reviewed in the Classics Preserved section of the Fajr Film Festival. Among them is Abbas Kiarostami's 1987 Where's the Friends House and Majid Majidi's 1999 Oscar-nominated film Children of Heaven. Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the 10-day event kicked off on February 1st and will wrap up with the announcement of winners on February 11th.
Fajr Film Festival is Iran's most iconic cinematic event, and the movies that win a Crystal Seymour will go down in the list of Iran's blockbusters. This makes it a tough competition among the participating films, so they all must be worthy of watching on the big screen. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. President Joe Biden, while on his campaign trail, had said that he would end the war on Yemen when he came into office. Instead, it appears that he has ratcheted up the war on Yemen in the form of military sales. In the span of a very short period of time, the U.S. has sold the UAE and Saudi Arabia hundreds of millions of dollars in military equipment. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. sales and even its presence in the war in Yemen has become more prominent.
When Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of then-President Barack Obama that it would last less than 7 weeks. But the war, aimed at reinstating a friendly regime in Yemen, has dragged on for over 7 years, with limited military gains for the invaders. Yemeni homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals have been struck with U.S.-made weapons. An all-out Saudi blockade has exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and disease like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those came amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. Donald Trump, who hailed from the opposite political camp in Washington, followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on May 20, 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest such deal in history. Trump had no compunction about the military support. During a visit by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the U.S., days before the third anniversary of the war on Yemen, he touted finalized and pending sales of military equipment to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. A year later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. In 2021, power changed hands in Washington, but any optimism for a change of policy quickly evaporated.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is also deploying a destroyer and fighter jets to the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. In the latest act of military support for the Saudi-led coalition, the U.S. State Department has approved a series of potential arms deals for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Jordan. Under the deals, both Saudi Arabia and the UAE will receive upgrades to their missile defense systems, and Jordan will get F-16s fighter aircraft. And as long as the U.S. reaps the economic benefits of such deals, the Yemeni people will continue to pay with their lives.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin, Frank M. Speck, joins us from Madison. And Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Karim joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, first to you over in Toronto. We're looking at another U.S. military sale that's gone on. This one has been an approval made by the State Department for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and then Jordan. The Saudi deal is worth about $23.7 million. It includes communication and navigation terminals. The UAE approved to buy $65 million in, spare parts for its missile defense, including Hawk, Patriot, and THAAD systems. And then Jordan, which was a big one. We'll get into that later. Why are these military sales happening in such a short period of time? In this case, the point we're zooming in on the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
Thank you very much. This deal just proves to the U.S. involvement in this war in Yemen. I truly believe that, it happened in a very short time, a short period of time, because, of the recent attacks that the Sana'a government or Ansar Allah have been launching towards UAE and Saudi Arabia. However, the fact that the state, the Defense Department, they've always been mentioning that that Saudi Arabia and the missiles and the defensive missiles have been selling Saudi Arabia, they were able to intercept 90% of the missiles and the drones sent from Yemen. And now they're trying to upgrade the systems for them and sell them more, which it's really contradicting, right? So you're saying that you're intercepting 90% of the drones and the missiles that have been used to attack Saudi Arabia, and now you're saying that you need to upgrade them because basically they're not doing the right job. That's one thing. And the other thing is that at the end of the day, this is, this is the U.S. war on Yemen. This war was announced from the U.S. This war has been continuing for 7 years without achieving any goals because of the U.S. support and backing for Saudi Arabia and UAE.
Mm-hmm. The point that you made there, Frank Emspeck, and it comes to you, it's a valid one made there by Hamza Karim. He's saying that when it comes to the statement made by Saudi Arabia and its coalition, in a sense, is that they have said that the success rate is actually pretty high in terms of the interception made on these drones. But at the same time, there's these sales that are happening. Is that part of an agreement that the sales continue to happen to continue this war by the U.S.?
Well, I don't know about agreements, but there was also an arrangement earlier in the week with Qatar, who was not allied so closely with Saudi Arabia, to treat them as a special ally. There is a level of support, it's a gradation of whether you're an ally or whether you have a treaty, and they were upgraded. So what we're seeing here, I think, is a continuation of something that's very, very serious, which is the complete militarization of our policies. And it almost doesn't make much difference which sale is which, because the whole perspective is a military-driven foreign policy. And you see that sort of, that's like the question of the hammer and the nail. To a hammer, the nail is it. There isn't any other solutions. And I think increasingly we're seeing that with American foreign policy. You certainly see that with NATO, where, incidentally, the issues, the arms sales, the treaties, outrun the purpose. As they said this morning, on a variety of different shows, actually, here in the United States, there were people speaking about the situation in the Ukraine, and they said, well, you know, if there's a war, the Ukrainians are devastated, Europe is devastated, but NATO as a treaty shows that it's really working. Well, the idea of these treaties and whatnot was to accomplish something, and what we're seeing is a totally counterproductive series of things going on which hurt the people in all the countries tremendously, especially Yemen. And so there is no other solution. If you talk about this, it's driven in large part by issues that have nothing to do with actually bringing any kind of stability to the area. They seem much more driven by the need that some people have to protect, grow, and support the American arms industry.
Well, why is that, Hamza Karim, that there is no political push or drive even mentioned when we take a look at the news on the war in Yemen coming from the U.S. In particular, but we can hear the condemnations that come on the country that's being bombed, and that is Yemen.
Yeah, if you're asking, as I mentioned.
No, Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, like for the past 7 years, U.S. and Saudi Arabia could not achieve any of their objectives militarily, and if there is any political solution that will be implemented in Yemen, this will show that the government or Sana'a or Ansarullah's side is the winning side, because right now on ground Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a they're expanding, and they will not compromise on any deals. So that will definitely show that Saudi Arabia and U.S. lost this war. That's the first point, I think, which is very important. This matter is very important, especially for Saudi Arabia, because MBS, for him to become the next king, he has to prove himself to be a strong man internally, whether the royal family or inside Saudi Arabia. So for him to lose this war, it's really threatening for him to be, it really threatens him to become the next king. The second point is that U.S. there is no reason for U.S. to push for a political resolution here. Their arms industry is booming. They're making billions and billions in terms of economic benefits, and they're not held accountable by the international community, because Saudi Arabia and UAE are really in the picture of this war. So for them, I don't see why they would really want a political resolution to take place in Yemen.
Well, Frank Imsbach, 1 year anniversary of President Biden declaring that the war needs to end, the offensive support, as he called it, but that the war needs to end was what this 1 year anniversary Friday marked. You had recently Democrats asking Joe Biden that he needs to clarify U.S. role in the Yemen conflict, and offer more than just vague declarations. I'm looking at the $650 million sale to Saudi Arabia, and then you're looking at this particular sale that has just happened. I don't see anything vague about the U.S. stance at this point, which means, as we have said, military sales. Where did Joe Biden sway from that? Because it looked like he was sincere.
Well, I think he swayed from it when they're, according to the newspapers, that the Houthis were able to successfully launch missiles and attack the rear of the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates. There are some American troops there, so that's an excuse to always side with the wrong side, I suppose. And I think that, internally, our meaning the United States sees its interests as the Saudi interests here, and it certainly sees the arms sales that way. So given those circumstances, we would side with the people with the cash. And the people with the cash are the Emirates and the Saudis, certainly not the Houthis, right? And so, there's a pressure to do that. And that's why I mean that the sales and things like that outweigh what would really be serious policy considerations about how to bring stability to the Middle East. Let's be serious here. We've invaded. We invaded Iraq on totally what everybody admits now is it was craziness, right? It just simply didn't happen. There were no weapons of mass destruction, but only because we have a completely militarized policy driven in part by a military-industrial complex. I mean, this is old hat in a certain sense, but you're right. There is not a political force in this country that's capable of taking on that complex.
Okay, this is what where it gets confusing, Hamza Karim. You have the news.
There'd be something, but we do not see that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were done there. I do apologize for that. Hamza Karim, this is where it gets confusing. When you take a look at the news recently, it keeps repeating one particular stance, and that is there's a new front that has now been opened on the war in Yemen. The Yemeni army has attacked the UAE deep in its territory. And it keeps repeating itself, and then you have other news attached to it that have followed, like developments regarding the U.S. being also involved, where it stepped in. It's shot down a couple of these, drones using the missile defense system, as they call it. Why is it that they call that a new front, but they don't come out and call the over 300,000 that perhaps have been killed or more and keep getting killed as that being a new front, because those civilian casualties are so much more?
Yeah,
who you
again,
at?
This is...
Hamza Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, this is, again, back to the highly depends. These matters really are related to U.S. interests in the region. The U.S. administration, not only this administration, like, if you think about it, since the war started in Yemen, there have been three different administrations that came into power in the U.S., it started with the Obama administration, Trump administration, and now Biden's administration. And throughout the three administrations, a lot of foreign policies have changed for the U.S. But one thing that is really in common between these three administrations is the war in Yemen. None of these administrations really wanted to stop this war, because eventually U.S. really looks at these wars and assess them based on their interests. Attacking UAE, attacking Saudi Arabia really hurts U.S. interests in the region. But killing civilians in Yemen really doesn't mean anything to U.S. So, yeah, again, U.S. is,
okay.
Based on this, U.S. is moving forward.
Sure. That's exactly a good lead into my question, Frank Emspach, to you. The U.S. is moving forward. It's actually becoming more prominent. I mentioned about how it thwarted, as it said, two of the missiles that were shot from the Yemeni army. It is also now becoming more visible by sending fighter jets, warships to the UAE. We understand, obviously, that the U.S. does have a base in the UAE, but you have the guided missile destroyer USS Cole to partner with the UAE Navy. Why is the U.S., or is the U.S. becoming more physically present in this war, and why did it decide to do to take that step?
I think that we're seeing in part the results of Afghanistan here, where the United States wants to make it clear that we're not going to be driven out of any place in the Middle East, and that we are still the people to have to go to for arms and equipment, and we're going to do that. I mean, let's be serious here. We are sort of tied at the hip with the Saudis. Here you have, if we go back three or four administrations to 9/11, right? The people who attacked the United States were all Saudis, and we attacked Afghanistan, you know? So unless we, you know, that was, you would think that we might have some issues with the Saudis or with the murder of that journalist, right? But that's not the case. And so we are wedded to the Saudi regime, which means we're wedded to having MBS become the king, and that he be successful. And in order to do that, he's got to win this war, as far as they're concerned. And that's it. And that is that's what's driving this, I think. And the immediacy, in a certain sense, was the precipitous withdrawal in Afghanistan. There was no reason to do that. You could have worked out an arrangement with the Taliban to have an orderly withdrawal. That's what they were trying to do. And bang, you know. And incidentally, by starving them to death, as we're trying to do also, that is a problem for us. It doesn't look good. So we might as well go ahead and do the military option, because that's really where the United States administration, all of them, have been comfortable.
Trying to understand how that is, Hamza Karim, when our guest Frank Emspach says that the U.S. is tied to the hips with the U.S. Walk us through this. You know, you have Saudi Arabia, in which the Crown Prince is, even by CIA standards, responsible for the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. You have the 9/11 incidents, where you have so many of them who were involved, Saudi citizens. And yet, when it comes to just a thing about oil production, the Saudis won't even help the U.S. out there. How is it that the U.S. is so bound with Saudi Arabia? Why?
I think Trump really answered this question very well when he was a president, and he said that when he was asked in a press conference why U.S. doesn't stop supporting Saudi Arabia, he said in a very concise and accurate statement, he said if we stop supporting Saudi Arabia, it means that there will be no Israel anymore. It's very obvious that Saudi Arabia and UAE and Israel, there is an alliance between them. All these countries think that their security, the security of Saudi Arabia and UAE, is really part of the security of Israel. And U.S. will never leave Israel alone, in the region, especially with rising powers in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq. It's taking more of an a regional perspective here rather than a one country problem.
While Hamza Karim was speaking there, Frank Emspach, I was thinking about how the U.S. is involved in this standoff with Russia over Ukraine. You have the situation of the U.S. involved in a crisis in the South China Sea with China. You have the U.S. involved in what we're looking at here in the war in Yemen, not to mention other military engagements. It almost takes one's breath away to think about the military engagements. Isn't the U.S. Kind of thin or going thin on all these?
Well, I don't know if it's going thin, but what's happening is that you are having a narrowing of the discussions here. And you also have a very weak government in the sense that you have a good portion of the population for the first time, a third, who's questioning the very legitimacy of the government. And so one response that has been, tried and true for many, many governments in many, many years is a military option, where you have a situation where there's crises and you have to rally behind the commander-in-chief. I don't think that can be completely dismissed here. But in terms of the Saudi issue, I think the United States has seen Saudi Arabia as the bastion of a politics, an anti-people politics, a politics which is extremely conservative, a politics which favors a certain type of capitalism. And that's it. That's the driver in terms of policy. And I don't think you're going to see much change there. To the extent that the Houthis or that people in Iraq or the people in Syria or the whole Arab Spring challenged those policies, those ideas, that organization of society, the United States was going to line up with Saudi Arabia, and did, and helped support, finance, and whatnot, all kinds of stuff since the Arab Spring to move the politics back to a more conservative, anti-people position, as we did in Egypt.
Final question to you. Hamza Karim, what is your reading into the war games that were held in which Saudi Arabia and Israel were involved with the U.S. and some other, 9,000 people from 60 regional navies, as it said? What is your reading into having that war game at this point, especially the fact that you have Saudi Arabia, along with Israel, participate in it with the U.S.?
The fact that this is happening in the Red Sea really shows us that Israel is really worried about, having the Red Sea under the control of Ansarullah or the government on Sana'a. Controlling the Red Sea means choking Israel, because if you control the Red Sea, it means that Israel doesn't have access to water, or, most of the ships that are going from Israel and from around the world to Israel
Thank
would
you.
Be could be under danger.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Hamza Karim, okay. Many thanks. Yemeni activist and political commentator. Frank Emsbach from Madison, thank you. Emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikava Tahwei. And the entire team is goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Citing figures from Johns Hopkins University, the World Bank, and the U.S. government, the New York Times reports that the U.S. deaths during the ongoing Omicron wave have now surpassed the worst days of the autumn surge of the Delta variant and are more than two-thirds as high as the record tolls of last winter, when vaccines were largely unavailable. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. has the highest COVID death rate among wealthy countries. Stay tuned for more. A new data analysis demonstrates that COVID-19 is now killing people at a significantly higher rate in the United States than in other rich countries, a grim reality that analysts have attributed to the nation's lagging vaccination campaign and, more broadly, its fragmented for-profit healthcare system. Citing figures from Johns Hopkins University, the World Bank, and the U.S. government, the New York Times reports that the country's death during the ongoing Omicron wave have now surpassed the worst days of the autumn surge of the Delta variant and are more than two-thirds as high as the record tolls of last winter when vaccines were largely available. Despite having one of the world's most powerful arsenals of vaccines, the country has failed to vaccinate as many people as other large, wealthy nations. Crucially, vaccination rates in older people also lag behind certain European nations, the Times noted, adding, the United States has fallen even further behind in administering booster shots, leaving large numbers of vulnerable people with fading protection as Omicron sweeps across the country. In addition to highlighting the role of rampant right-wing disinformation in vaccine hesitancy among many Americans, Experts and commentators have pointed to structural barriers such as poverty, lack of paid sick leave, and massive levels of uninsurance as key factors hindering the U.S. pandemic response and giving up the coronavirus death toll. Research by Kaiser Family Foundation has shown that unvaccinated Americans are more likely to be uninsured than vaccinated adults. Many more Americans would be vaccinated if healthcare system wasn't so terrifying, healthcare journalist Natalie Shore argued in a column for New Republic last year, adding, though Congress passed legislation mandating that COVID-19 vaccines be free at a point of use for all U.S. residents, around one-third of unvaccinated people cited fear of cost as a significant reason they have yet to get the jab. Shore noted, as it happens, patients across the country have been slapped with coronavirus-related medical bills throughout the pandemic, sometimes getting hit with steep charges for testing and treatment in spite of Congress's mandates. Even if such events are rare, the startlingly widespread concern about it poses an undeniable threat to public health. And it's just the latest illustration of the havoc wrought by a healthcare system that millions of people are too terrified to use. According to a study released in December by West Health and Gallup, 30% of U.S. adults reported skipping treatment for a health program in the prior 3 months, and nearly 60% said the pandemic heightened their concerns about healthcare costs. One in every 20 U.S. adults, an estimated 12.7 million people, report knowing a friend or family member who died this past year after not receiving treatment because they could not afford it, the study found. While the Times analysis doesn't emphasize the potentially massive impact the for-profit U.S. healthcare system has had on the country's vaccination effort and coronavirus death rate, the newspaper does point to economic factors, highlighting survey data which indicates that the poorest Americans are the likeliest to remain unvaccinated, putting them at greater risk of dying from COVID. You know what every country on this graph, except for the United States, has asked political anthropologist and physician Eric Reynard in response to the Times analysis, adding universal healthcare guarantee to every resident. Almost seems like that might matter for public health and the trust in medicine, science, and government upon which public health depends, Reynard added. Daniel Farber, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, added that the Times data compilation spotlights the dark side of American exceptionalism. On average, the coronavirus is killing an estimated 2,600 people every day in the U.S., a staggering figure that expats fear is becoming normalized among the country's political establishment and population. If we want to declare the end of the pandemic right now, what we are doing is normalizing a very high rate of death, and so soon, a health equity researcher at Dartmouth College told the Times. Progressives have argued throughout the pandemic that privatized U.S. healthcare system, with its sky-high costs and countless barriers to treatment, left the country dangerously unprepared to combat the threat of COVID-19. The consumer advocacy group Public Citizen estimated in a report last March that hundreds of thousands of coronavirus deaths likely would have been prevented if the U.S. had a single-payer Medicare for All system. Under Medicare for All, everyone would have consistent coverage regardless of their employment status or employer, the report argued. And because Americans would have their choice of providers instead of facting the narrow networks their employers choose for them, they would face fewer challenges getting care. especially during a pandemic where some hospitals and providers are overwhelmed by demand.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.